It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Today we learn about a 2,000-year-old food that's being treated like the latest rock star discovery. It's tofu. A lot of people have become tofu groupies. Me? Well, it's not high on my list. But if anyone can make me a tofu fan, it's our guest, vegetarian cooking genius Deborah Madison. Jane and Michael Stern have discovered strangely provincial dishes in Chicago. Gadget Queen Dory Greenspan checks out garlic gear. We salute A-Rabbers in Baltimore. And we've got a take on hospital food you're not going to believe. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this. It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with Kitchen Chronicles, where knowledge is power and cooking is pleasure, a practical guide to nourishing ourselves and the people we care about. Today, I want to talk about blueberries. They're coming into season, and they're going to be with us most of the summer. Now, there are two different types of blueberries. I've tasted some good cultivated blueberries, and that's what we eat almost all the time. But during a vacation in Maine one summer, I had my first wild blueberry. They're the size of plump buckshot, really tiny, and they taste sweet, but with this tangy bite, kind of as though you put some black pepper in the sugar bowl. Our big discovery was that local women baked the wild blueberries into pies and sold them. Wild blueberry pie. It was so good, we sat on the beach and just ate it with our hands. Four people polished off an entire pie in about 10 minutes. So if you run across wild blueberries, do not pass them up, even if you have to pick them yourself. In fact, that sounds like a lot more fun than just going to the farm stand. Okay, most of the time we're not going to find wild blueberries. So what to buy? First, seek out organic. Often the flavor's better. Now, when you look at boxes of blueberries in the stores, they all seem alike, but they're not. There's about 50 varieties of blueberries that are grown in the United States, and each one tastes different. So always sample before buying. You got to have courage here. You got to gently lift that cellophane cover of that little box, reach in, and very discreetly take a berry. I can hear the grocers all getting on the phone now. But guys, we're the customer. Put out samples. It'll save you a lot of problems. Okay, once you've found blueberries you like, think about freezing some for winter. It's easy. Just rinse the berries, dry them, then spread them on a cookie sheet and freeze. Once they're solid, fill up heavy freezer bags with them, press out all the air, seal it, and you're done. They'll hold nicely for about 6 months. You can make a really easy blueberry sauce. Just boil the berries with sugar to taste, add some orange zest, a pinch of salt, a cinnamon stick, and cook it until it's thick. Use this over fruit or ice cream or cake. There's a great trick when you bake with blueberries. Toss them with a little flour. That way, when you put them in a cake batter or a muffin batter, they won't all sink to the bottom. Now, personally, I think the best thing that can happen to blueberries is blueberry pie. I have never been able to get that wild blueberry pie out of my mind, so I've come up with a trick that makes cultivated berries taste a little bit wild. Use any blueberry pie recipe you like, but substitute dried blueberries for about a quarter of the berry measurement. Soak them, then mince them, then blend them in with the fresh fruit. Here's how I do it. Now, this is for a two-crusted 9-inch pie. Have the oven at about 450 degrees and set an oven rack as low as possible. When you bake a pie near the bottom of the oven, you get a crisper bottom crust. Roll out your pie pastry, line a 9-inch pan, and then roll out another big circle of dough that'll cover the pie. I usually do this about an hour ahead and chill the two pieces. For the filling, take a generous 3 cups of blueberries and then a 1/2 cup of dried blueberries. Soak those, drain them, chop them up. Toss all that fruit with the grated zest of a lemon, about a half a cup of sugar, and then a tablespoon each of cornstarch and lemon juice. I always add a generous pinch of salt and black pepper. The black pepper kind of sparks the blueberry sweetness. Fill up your pie shell, cover it with the top pastry, seal them together, and then make some cuts in the top to let the steam escape. Now set the pie on a cookie sheet and bake 20 minutes. Turn the heat down to 400 and bake another 20 to 30 minutes. The blueberries should be bubbling. Cool the pie on a rack and serve it up. So keep your eye out for wild blueberries, try a blueberry pie, and join us for the next edition of Kitchen Chronicles. It's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Club Wed Gift Registry at Target, featuring Henkel's top-of-the-line, fully forged professional cutlery. Henkel's is the knife choice of many professional chefs. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Vagley Productions and is distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. You've probably heard soybeans might be the newest wonder food, which has led to a lot of tofu consumption in the United States. Now, tofu's been around for about 2,000 years, but for us, it is the hot new deal. Everybody wants to give it a try. So today, we learn how to work tofu into our everyday eating from one of the most gifted and realistic vegetarian cooks I know, Deborah Madison. Her new book is aptly called This Can't Be Tofu. Well, another practical cook, our kitchen gadget queen, Dory Greenspan, checks out garlic gear. Dory resolves the age-old garlic dilemma, to press or not to press. We hear from one of Baltimore's last Arabbers, that's street peddlers who sell produce from horse-drawn wagons. Then we go to a hospital where patients can't wait for the dinner tray, Boston's Massachusetts General. Finally, and as always, in the second half of the show, we're opening the lines for your calls. The number is 800-537-5252. So let's get rolling with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Two for the Road column in Gourmet Magazine.
Hi, Lynn.
Hi, Jane. What's up?
I think I'm going to go out and have a cup of coffee because we're going to talk about Chicago. And, you know, when Michael and I start talking about Chicago, I might as well not be here. So Michael's going to tell you about two Chicago hometown favorites, Chicken Vesuvio and Shrimp Dijon. So maybe I'll just yell in from the other room occasionally and say hi.
Well, enjoy the coffee, Jane.
Here he goes.
Goodbye, Jane. No, Jane will be here if she has a comment to make. But I think it's especially appropriate that she not say anything about Chicken Vesuvio and Shrimp Dijon.
I told you.
Because the truth is that you have to have been raised in Chicago really to even know about them. They're these strangely provincial dishes that are unique to Chicago. You can't really grow up in the city without knowing about them, and yet they're dishes that few people outside the city know about. Shrimp Dijon has a long history. It's over a century old. It goes back to the Columbian Exposition. The Dijon brothers had a restaurant there where they invented it. It's sherry, breadcrumbs, and lots of garlic with baked in a ramekin with shrimp. Baked so that the garlic, sherry, and breadcrumbs get sort of crusty around the shrimp. It's a fabulous idea.
Well, it sounds good. I mean,
simple and wonderful, and it's the kind of thing that every Italian restaurant and many non-Italian restaurants in Chicago serve.
It's like a much... I'm back. You know, I didn't stay long.
Jane
too long. It's
makes
like,
a wonderful shrimp Dijon.
Well,
for a non-Chicagoan.
Yeah, well, thank you. It's like shrimp scampi, but the it's sort of like a puffy sherry flavored bready thing on the top rather than just being garlic and butter in the shrimp. There's something very kind of ladies' tea room about it,
uh-huh.
I think.
Uh-huh.
You know, I mean, really, who among us puts sherry, you know, and butter into ramekins anymore? But it is wonderful, and I do bow to my Second City husband as having eaten shrimp de jong way before I ever knew about it.
You have to tell us about chicken Vesuvio, is it? Vesuvius?
Chicken Vesuvio, even more obscure than shrimp de jong, is
right.
Chicken Vesuvio, named, we believe, and no one really knows for sure, we believe it was named because it is made, when it is made, it resembles a great volcano. What it is chicken that is braised and then baked forever and a day, so that the meat is just about ready to fall off the bone,
right.
And the skin, which is permeated with the savor of chicken fat and plastered with herbs, kind of peels off the chicken like strips of bacon.
But, Michael, you're forgetting the most important part of the chicken.
I was about to say,
okay.
Along with the chicken is cooked kind of logs of potato that get saturated with the juices of the chicken and the herbs, and the potato is cooked so that the outside is kind of crisp and firm, and the inside is more soft than mashed potatoes.
All right.
You really see a volcano in it?
Yes. It's mountainous.
Where do you eat these things? I mean, now I really want to try them.
We have two suggestions for each, and a wonderful old restaurant, Gene and Giorgetti, which most people know is the great steak place in Chicago. It's kind of a 1930s-era manly supper club with brusque waiters, with indeed great steaks, but they make a tremendous Vesuvio and shrimp de jong. They also make lobster de jong, which is too rich to even talk about. The other place is Harry Carey's restaurant, a kind of, you know, modern, it's not really a sports bar because the food is way too good to even call it that, but it's opened by sportscaster Harry Carey. The phone number is 773-HOLY-COW in honor of his most famous expression, and they make a sensational chicken Vesuvio.
You know, I do have to just say this. I think this is a weird piece of culinary history or an oddity, is that when Michael said these were little-known dishes, it's true. I would venture to say that nobody in the United States in any restaurant serves either chicken Vesuvio or shrimp de jong, but yet they're ubiquitous in this enormous city
mm-hmm.
of Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
But it's so funny that unlike buffalo chicken wings or Tucson chimichangas, they haven't spread, you know, that they've just remained a local addiction.
Well, maybe it's because Michael has been guarding them very carefully.
I want them all for myself.
Well, now your secret's out. Ha ha.
Thank you both.
Bye.
Bye, Lynn.
Bye.
Oh, baby, don't you want to go? Oh, tell me, don't you want to go? To that bright light city, sweet old Chicago.
Shane and Michael Stern are authors of Eat Your Way Across the USA. They're here every week with a new report, and every week you can get their food finds on our website at splendidtable.org. On that very same site, you'll find the Splendid Table store. It has some of my favorite foods and equipment and copies of Eat Your Way Across the USA, autographed by Jane and Michael, just for you public radio listeners. Tuck one in the car and another in your suitcase, and know all the proceeds from the store go to support the show. Dory Greenspan writes award-winning cookbooks, a column for Bon Appetit magazine, and loves to check out kitchen equipment. She tests pieces to see if they deliver what they promise. Things like cheese graters, handheld blenders, and pepper mills. She names names, and Dory shows up regularly here at the Splendid Table with the results. Dory, welcome.
Hi there.
So what have you been testing?
I've been playing around with garlic gear, all this stuff.
Uh-huh.
You know, I remember, maybe you saw this, I once saw Jacques Pepin race a food processor.
What?
It was a fabulous contest in which we were to see whether the machine or the man would puree a clove of garlic the fastest. And Jacques Pepin won. And ever since that time, I have had the most extraordinary case of knife envy. I mean, I would just love to be that good with a knife. You know, and I'm not. But when it comes to garlic, I've been playing around with this gear, and I realize that even I can look like I have a PhD in chopping. For instance, the garlic press. Now, the garlic press has been around for a really long time. But there's a whole new generation of garlic presses, self-cleaning presses, that actually live up to their names.
In what sense? I mean,
well, you know what a garlic press looks like. It looks a little bit like a lemon squeezer with teeth or a mini meat tenderizer, you know, nutcracker. And you put the garlic, the handles go around in like a three-quarter arc. And you put the garlic clove in this little basket that has open holes on one side and close the handles tight. And it pushes the flat against one of the sides, pushes the garlic through the little holes. And you just have to scrape your knife against the little holes, and you've got garlic puree.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then you've got an endless job of cleaning the garlic out of those little holes. But the new garlic presses come with a whole set of little plastic teeth. And when you turn the handles in the opposite direction, the teeth fit into the little holes and push all that gunk out the other side. And these two brands in particular that I've been using, Pedrini and OXO Good Grips, really do get your garlic press clean.
Hmm. What about other ways of cutting up garlic?
Well, the ingenious tool, I think, is the garlic slicer. And it looks like a little, essentially it's a mini mandolin. It's a thin panel. I have one in plastic and one in metal.
Uh-huh.
And it has a cutting blade on it and a little box that slides up and down along the panel. And you put the garlic clove into the little box. There's a little gripper to hold the clove in there. And you just go up and down as though you were grating a potato. And you get, I think of them as garlic petals. You get paper-thin, translucent slices of garlic, the kind that you get in the best Chinese stir-fries.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
You've done nothing except slide up and down.
Do you have a brand?
I have one. The one that's made, it's kind of interesting. The first one that I bought is made by Help Me, Lynn, because it's an Italian name.
Yeah.
A-C-E-A.
Ache. A-C-E-A. Ache. Or Ache.
Thank you. Well, that's the brand of the first one that I bought. And it's made of stainless steel, and it costs
$2.98. $2.98. Now you're singing my song.
Okay. $2.98 to make you look like a pro. Unfortunately, I haven't seen it again. I bought it about 3 months ago. And what has turned up is this plastic model. I say this because I'm actually sliding it up and down right here. It's made completely of plastic, dishwasher safe, does a great job of slicing, and costs $6.98. But the stainless steel one, if you can find it, is either one of them really works very, very well.
Anything else?
The last thing I want to talk about is my newest garlic toy. It's a tear-shaped, like a teardrop of stainless steel. It's called Odor Away.
What?
So, exactly. After you've pureed, after you've sliced, after you've cleaned your press and your slice, you don't smell so good. The kitchen smells fine, but you don't.
Mm-hmm.
And this little teardrop of stainless steel is meant to take the smell of garlic off your fingers. It looks like a hand warmer, or actually some sort of mystical talisman. It has a picture of a fish kind of looking as though it's swimming through a garlic clove, and it says Dios on it, D-E-O-S. I don't know what it means. To me, Dios must be like the god of kitchen smells.
Mm-hmm.
But if you
if you
put your hands under running water and rub this stainless steel teardrop over your fingers, magically it removes the smell of garlic from your hands.
Tori, are you serious?
I am. Now, you can probably get the same results with a stainless steel spoon, but this one's so much more fun.
I don't know if I'm going to bite for the teardrop, but it fascinates me. Hey, thanks.
Thanks. It's been swell being with you.
Tori Greenspan is co-author of Daniel Ballou's Café Ballou Cookbook. Her column, Tools of the Trade, appears in Bon Appetit magazine. Coming up, a religious experience for some, tofu with vegetarian expert Deborah Madison, and the last of Baltimore's A-Rabbers and your calls. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This is The Splendid Table, distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Target, dedicated to helping you discover new and exciting ideas that help you enjoy everything there is about cooking for your friends and family, just like you do here at The Splendid Table each week, online at Target.com. I love the way we Americans grab onto an idea, turn it into a trend, practically beat it into the ground, and then discard it and move on. The soybean is in the trend stage right now, which has moved tofu into the spotlight. Now, tofu has been a mainstay in Asia for about 2,000 years, but for us, it's a brand new discovery. And, true to form, many have embraced it with almost religious conviction. For a bit more balanced take on the topic, we're turning to the empress of vegetarian cooking, Deborah Madison, who has a new book with a title I think sums things up nicely. This Can't Be Tofu. Deborah, welcome.
Hello, Lynn.
Deborah, people who hear the show know that, I guess the nice way to put it is, I've got some issues with tofu. And you, I mean, how did you do an entire book on this stuff?
Well, it's an entire little book, I should say.
It's a book on tofu,
It's a book on tofu. It actually came about, I never would have dreamed of doing this myself. I was asked if I knew somebody who could do a little book on tofu. And I never did find anybody because I forgot about it. And I thought, you know, I'd like to do this myself because one is I actually grew up becoming familiar with tofu at a very early age through Japanese restaurants in Sacramento when I was a teenager. And I liked it. I knew in its traditional dishes. And I wanted to find a way to present tofu to people that didn't try to make it into something that it isn't. It's a very neutral, it's a very delicate food. You can lead it in a lot of exciting directions, partly because of its neutrality, or you can appreciate it for its delicacy. It's very fast to cook.
I love the idea of leading it. That's kind of a nice image, you know? I can put a leash on this baby and I can lead it. What exactly is tofu?
Well, I think of tofu as cheese or as yogurt. It is it's soy milk, which is made from pureed soybeans. It looks very much like a thick, full fat, rich milk.
Uh-huh.
It's coagulated then with a salt like calcium nitrate and curds and whey form. Then the curds are pressed, and if they're not pressed very much, you end up with a very soft curd. If they're pressed more, you get something that's more firm, and if they're pressed a lot, you get something that's extra firm, and all of these are forms of tofu. Another kind of tofu, which is made more like yogurt, curds and whey don't form, but the whole thing solidifies just as yogurt does when you add yogurt culture to milk, and that makes a very silky, silky, smooth tofu.
So I guess it's soy cheese.
I hadn't thought of that way. It is. It's soy cheese, but it's not cheese like cheddar or fontina. It's cheese like ricotta or like yogurt or yogurt cheese.
Okay. Well, okay. Now to the use of it, because one of the problems I've got with tofu is people keep saying to you, you can use tofu instead of mayonnaise, and you can use tofu instead of sour cream, and you know what? You can't, because it doesn't taste like sour cream or mayonnaise.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more on that. You can, in fact, work tofu very neatly into mayonnaises, into all kinds of sauces, because it disappears. But I never let it just completely replace those ingredients. If it's mayonnaise, I include some mayonnaise. If it's a sauce with herbs or something, I put in the sour cream or olive oil or whatever else I might be using. Yogurt, sour cream, things that have tang are going to be conveyed. Tofu itself doesn't have it. So I think it becomes useful as an ingredient with other things, but not as a total substitute for them.
But are there places where tofu really shines?
Yeah, I think that there are. I think that tofu shines when it's accompanied with the flavors that exist in the cultures where tofu is eaten. So tofu that's cooked with ginger, with garlic, with different kinds of soy sauce, with chili. It's fabulous with cilantro, but you can also go into the direction of lemongrass, Thai chili paste, or Indian curry paste are wonderful. Coconut milk and coconut milk-based curries are lovely with tofu. Hoisin sauce, oyster sauce, all of these rather intense, pungent seasonings, I think, they don't disguise tofu. They harmonize. They work beautifully with it. Where I think it doesn't work for you and for me and probably a lot of other people is when you are given a wedge of lasagna and there in the middle is what you think is a piece of mozzarella or ricotta cheese and you bite into it and it's tofu and that just isn't right. Not for me anyway.
Yeah, and I would agree with you there. Are there places where the tofu, in all its delicacy, really stand out? I mean, is this because we've been talking about spices?
Yeah, I can give you an example that I'm very fond of. But I will say to start with, it depends on using tofu that's impeccably fresh and beautifully made, where you really appreciate its delicacy. And this is a summer dish I ate in New York last summer during a heat wave. And it was big cubes of tofu that were served in a bowl of ice. Water and ice, and you pull them out, and then you dip them into a sauce of soy sauce and scallions and ginger. And this was so perfectly lovely and soothing and restorative. That may not be for every American palate, but that's how I really do enjoy tofu.
Is that a traditional Japanese dish?
Yes, it is. And I can't remember what the name is, so please don't ask, but it is.
No, I'll let you off the hook on that one.
Some easier versions of that, I mean, that are in this little book are summer salads, for example, where I've taken tofu and I just simmer it for a few minutes in salted water. It gives it a little firmness. And it also sometimes improves the flavor, especially if people are using the kind of tofu that comes in aseptic packages. It rounds out the flavor and it makes it better. But then I toss that with cooked spinach and toasted sesame seeds, a little scallion, soy, and ginger, or with soba noodles. And these make very mild summer dishes where the inherent flavor of tofu comes forward quite nicely.
So, Deborah, where would we find really fresh tofu?
I always find the freshest tofu is going to be found in Asian grocery stores. It used to be, when I bought tofu in San Francisco, you would find it in big barrels, and it was just floating in water. And you knew that because of the way it was packaged, which was just floating in water, that people were going to buy it, bring it home, and cook it that day. And that is fresh. Today you don't see it in barrels so much, but you will see it packaged in cartons. With water surrounding it. And often you'll find brands that you've never seen before. They're not national brands. They're going to be very local brands. When you buy it in the grocery store, however, what we mean by fresh is use it well before the expiration date. Try to use it all at once you get it home. Don't keep it around, you know, in a container thinking you're going to use that other piece later on. Plan to use it all at once.
Should you always press the tofu?
Oh, that's this myth, I think, that those of us who were eating tofu in the 60s have cast into the future and cement. No, you don't have to do it. The only time you really need to press tofu is if you're planning to deep fry. Because, you know, there's water in the tofu and it hits oil and it is not a happy combination. But no, you don't need to press tofu. If you throw tofu unpressed right into a pan, like you cut it in a slab, you put it in a skillet, that water will come out, it will cook away, and the tofu will actually go on to brown, just on its own, or you can add a little oil.
Huh.
It's fast. I mean, that's just a very preliminary cooking. You can toss in some Worcestershire sauce, some steak sauce, some soy sauce, wonderful marinades with palm sugar or brown sugar and soy, and you get this beautiful sort of lacquered glazed coating on your tofu, which I think makes it very appealing.
That I could eat. That I could eat. Deborah, thank you.
You're welcome.
A little taste might hit the spot. A little taste might help a lot. It may be nice and maybe not. In my condition, this is a risky proposition. A little taste might pave the way. It has been known to save the day. One little taste might be okay. It's a sedation, good for a sticky situation.
Deborah Madison is author of This Can't Be Tofu. You can get her recipe for lacquered tofu triangles with green beans and cashews two ways. Either send a self-addressed stamped envelope to the Splendid Table, care of Minnesota Public Radio, St. Paul, Minnesota 55101. That's the Splendid Table, care of MPR, St. Paul, Minnesota 55101. Or go to our website at splendidtable.org. Baltimore, Maryland is maybe the last big city in America where you can still see peddlers with horse-drawn carts hawking their fresh fruits and vegetables in city neighborhoods. This Baltimore tradition dates back to the 1700s. The peddlers are called Arabbers. Some people say it's a slang term for their itinerant lifestyle. One of Baltimore's last Arabbers is Donald Waugh. He began Arabbing as a child during the Depression.
Cantaloupe, cantaloupe, sweet cantaloupe, peaches, cantaloupe, strawberries, strawberries, strawberries by the quart, sweet strawberries, strawberries.
When I was coming up, it used to be horse and wagons everywhere all around the city. When I used to get out of school, I used to work on a horse and wagon, help on the wagon selling produce. During that time, people used to use coal and also ice. They had ice boxes then. And I would go out and sell ice on the wagon. Some people used to buy 10-cent piece, 15-cent piece, 25-cent piece, 35-cent piece ice. And you had to know how to cut ice. If you didn't, it would crack all up. And I remember years back, we used to buy chickens. They used to have chickens, too. We used to buy live chickens. And we used to carry them on a wagon. We used to have them on a bunch, like two chickens. And people used to buy them, and they would kill them themselves. I ain't kidding. It was the truth. And chop the heads off and cook them. You know, live chickens. And during that time, we just horse and wagon everywhere. It was stables, just about everywhere. When you're selling produce, you go along slow. See, you're going along slow, and like you would stop and you'll say, "Oh, mister," and I'll stop right there. And I'll say, "Yes, can I help you?" And then you'll say, "Do you have any bananas?" And I'll say, "Yes." And you say, "Well, you got any corn?" I say, "Yes, I got some corn." And then you say, "Wait a minute, I'll be right over." You know, you'd be on the other side of the street. And in the meantime, somebody else might come up. At one time, I used to have about 6-7 horses, but now things are slow. It's not like it used to be. Everything is real slowing down, you know. And at one time, it used to be so many, you know, guys that sold produce, but majority of them died out. But it used to be a lot of them. It used to be, I know, a couple hundred of them. But now, you know, in the later years, the majority of the older guys died out. And now there's very few that drive the wagons now. I think you can almost count them. I guess you got about 15 or maybe less than that drive wagons, you know. But it's really history. It's history because you don't see this nowhere else, and Baltimore is about the only place that has it, you know. It's really nice and different, you know.
Hey, banana! Banana! Baby, tell, mommy, tell.
That was Donald Waugh, one of the last Arabbers in Baltimore, Maryland. Our profile of him was produced by Lex Gillespie. time for my favorite part of the show. We are opening the lines for your calls. Phone us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Anything goes. Let's get right to the phones. We have Jenny on the line. Jenny, what's on your mind?
Hi, Lynn. I have a question about Pope ladies. Pope ladies are something my family has eaten for years, and we always have them on Christmas morning with marmalade. But we don't know where they came from. The article that my mother found the recipe in, it said that they are eaten in England on New Year's Day. But everyone that I ask who is from England, if they've ever heard of Pope ladies, has never heard of them. And so I'm just curious about the origins and was wondering if you'd ever heard of them.
Well, no, I've never heard of them, and you're going to have to explain what in heaven's name is a Pope lady.
But it's kind of a mixture of terms there. A Pope lady, it's made from a sweet dough, risen dough, yeast dough.
Uh-huh.
And you form them into little bodies. There's a body and a head and two little arms and,
oh,
and little currents going down for buttons. And we always roll a little nose and give it an egg wash. And they're delicious.
You bake it. So it's like a sweet bread that meets a ginger man.
Exactly.
Is it shaped flavored like a gingerbread man?
Yes, if you can imagine a risen fat gingerbread man.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
The doughboy meets the gingerbread man, something
exactly
like that. Exactly. Okay.
And it's sweetened, or it's got nutmeg in it.
Boy, I have never heard of them. And but I there may be a way of finding out where they come from.
Uh-huh.
You think they're English. I mean, your mother found an article, right?
That's what it says in the article.
You know, online now, I just started playing around with this. If you say you're looking for food history,
yes,
there's lots of websites, and I would bet you that the origins of this probably are in the medieval period or the Renaissance period.
Somewhere back there.
Yeah, and you may even start a dialogue in a chat room, a food history chat room. I'm serious. This is the way you learn about this stuff.
I think it'd be great.
Yeah.
There's somebody out there who has to know what the origins are.
And not only that, but what an interesting name, Pope Ladies.
Pope Ladies.
Well, you know, I'm just thinking, you know, popes in the golden olden days, popes did things that popes don't do today. Do you know Lucretia Borgia was a pope's daughter?
No.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Well.
So popes got around. I'd say check it out online.
I will.
And start asking questions.
I will.
Yeah. Sorry we couldn't help you, Jenny.
Well, it's always fun to, you know, try all the different avenues.
Well, yeah, we're one that turned out to be a dead end.
No, never.
May you have better luck elsewhere.
Thank you, Lynn.
Hey, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Okay, it's time for trivia, our weekly trivia question. Here it is. What supermarket mainstay was first unveiled in Oklahoma in 1937? Again, the question is, what supermarket item was first unveiled in Oklahoma back in 1937? We'll be back in a moment with that answer. The best restaurateur in Massachusetts, and I think you're going to be surprised by this one, and more of your calls. So get to those phones. The number is 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This is The Splendid Table, distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. We're taking your calls this hour, so get on the line at 800-537-5252. But before we launch into more of your questions, I've got the answer to this week's trivia question. The question was, what supermarket mainstay was first unveiled in Oklahoma in 1937? Well, it was the shopping cart. A man named Sylvan Goldman developed it, and the idea was that people could buy more in a single visit. Well, of course, you all know what the supermarket evolved into by the time the 80s came around. A trip to the market wasn't just about filling that shopping cart. By all accounts, the supermarket was a great place for singles to meet. You'd hang out in the aisles where your favorite foods were and wait to see who showed up. Well, according to my single friend Peter, all that's changed now. Everybody's at the gym. He says he can't even cook for his dates anymore. All they do is push food around on their plates and ask if he used cooking spray to saute the fish. Talk about self-centered. I am putting out a call to action. All you single food lovers, get those folks out of the gym and into those supermarket aisles. Teach them a little generosity of spirit, a little hedonism. Shop together. Cook together. Eat. You can have sticky buns and buns of steel. I mean, come on, guys. Prioritize. Now we're going back to the phones. We're taking your calls this hour, and the number's 800-537-5252. Okay, let's see who's up. We've got Missy on the line. Hi, Missy. What's up?
Well, I bought some South American fruit paste in tins online, and I have no idea what to do with them.
All right, I've got to know something. You have no idea what to do with them, and you bought them online. Now, what motivated you to buy them?
Oh, it looked so interesting, and the flavors were so interesting. One of them is pumpkin coconut, and one is sweet potato, and another was banana.
Oh, who could resist? You mean they're actually, are they like purees?
Well, I opened one tin, and they're really big. They're like probably two and a half cups worth of stuff in each tin. And I opened one and mixed it with some whipped cream to fill a cake, but it went bad really fast. You had to refrigerate the cake all the time to make it work, you know, to make it stay good. And then the rest of the tin, I didn't know what to do with, and it's really thick. It's like the consistency of really thick guava jelly.
That's thick.
So you really just had to beat the heck out of it to incorporate it with the whipped cream, and so I haven't figured out what to do with the other two tins I have.
All right, so now what are you asking then? Which are the tins that you're not sure of what to do with?
I have a sweet potato and a pumpkin coconut, and I don't want to open them
until
I know what to do.
Now, you said they're from South America. What does it say on the can? Where exactly are each one of them from? Do you remember?
I think Argentina.
Aha, okay. See, what I love about this is I haven't done much of that kind of shopping online, but I go into these ethnic grocery stores, and I come out with bags of stuff. Which I put away in the closet, and I always say now I'm going to go and look in my cookbooks and figure out how to use them. And sometimes I actually do, and a lot of times 2 years later I get to the back of the closet, and guess what?
Exactly.
Okay, let's save you from this experience. I am not sure. The sweet potato paste, there's probably a lot of stuff you can do with it, but one thing that occurs to me is I keep thinking there's this Indonesian recipe that I had at a restaurant in California a long time ago. And you know, the sweet potato spread all over the world practically.
Mm-hmm.
This was where they took, and you probably could do this with a dense paste, it would be delicious, sweet potato, ground rice, and palm sugar. And if you don't have palm sugar, you use brown sugar.
Mm-hmm.
And you mix that together. And then you roll it in a little bit of the ground rice, and you deep fry the little balls.
Oh, that sounds fabulous.
It is so good. I mean, a little salt doesn't hurt, just a tad of salt. It is so delicious. So that's one idea. Another thing is, why not use it to make a sweet potato filling?
Well, that's what I wondered, but I didn't know. you know, I'm afraid if it's going to be too pasty, if I mix it with eggs, if it's going to separate or if it's going to...
It probably won't separate, but if you dilute it with a little bit of milk.
Oh, okay.
You know, think pumpkin pie.
Right.
Except you don't need that much sugar.
Right.
Now, the other one, the other can is what? That was the
pumpkin coconut.
Okay. How about... Oh, you know what would be great with the pumpkin coconut? How
what?
About filling empanadas with that?
Oh, that sounds terrific.
You know, make any kind of like a pie pastry if you want, all right?
Mm-hmm.
Cut it into rounds and then flavor that pumpkin coconut paste. Taste it because it may be bland.
Right.
And what would be fun in there is to throw in some diced chilies and fresh ginger and black pepper and maybe browned onions.
Terrific.
You know, make it sweet savory. And I don't know, I guess I'd soak some raisins in lime juice and add that too.
Oh, wow.
And maybe some lime juice to taste.
That sounds terrific.
And then put that inside, you know, stuff the empanada, you know, put them on the round, fold it over, crimp the edges, and then you could brush it with egg and bake it.
That sounds like a perfect vegetarian entree.
It could be absolutely delicious, and you could make tiny ones if you wanted to for snacking in the car.
Oh, wow. Well, that sounds great. Thank you so much.
Hey, thank you. And where did you get it online? What's the name of that? What's the?
It's called Querico, Querico.com.
Querico.com.
Mm-hmm.
And it's South American products.
Well, from all different countries, and it's wonderful. You can find almost anything on there.
This sounds great.
Well, thanks again.
Another way to stock up the shelves. Stuff I hopefully will use soon. Hey, thank you, Missy.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
Goodbye. I love the way these new ingredients kind of lure us into trying new dishes. I just had one in Italy. I was in one of my favorite parts of Italy where balsamic vinegar is produced around Modena. And I was served a big platter. It was just incredible, of grilled chilies right off of wood-fired grill with grilled onions. And it had been drizzled with saba syrup. And I've talked about saba before. It's wine grapes that you boil down and make a syrup. And if you let it age, you make balsamic vinegar. I mean, it's more complicated than that. But anyway, saba is great at this time of year. It's the kind of thing on hot foods, spicy foods, on grilled foods, over peaches. It's a sweet tart syrup. You can take a look at it at the Splendid Table store, splendidtable.org, and in specialty food stores, probably all over the country. So check it out. It's called Saba. Okay, let's get back to the phones. The number is 800-537-5252, and we've got Harris on the line. Harris, what do you want to talk about?
Well, first of all, let me just say you're my favorite food person.
Oh, hey, thank you.
It's my pleasure. Anyway, it's a very simple question. I have some recipes which call for beans being cooked at some length in a lamb shank stew. And I would like to use some canned beans instead.
Uh-huh.
So the question really is, when do I put these beans in and how do I use the sauce that comes in the can and how long will I cook them?
Okay.
It's a four-hour, approximately, lamb shank stew.
The stew sounds great.
It is great.
The devil with the beans. I want to eat the stew. this is the thing with them. You should be able to use canned beans.
Yes.
I always rinse the beans. I don't use the liquid.
Oh, you don't use the liquid.
No,
because
usually
right.
It's salty and yucky. And,
yes.
You know, the beans are great, but we can do without the liquid.
Okay.
I rinse them and you know, put them in a colander and run cold water over them and let them drain.
But how long should I cook them?
Well, they're already cooked.
Right.
And you want them to absorb a little bit of the flavor of your lamb stew. Is there a lot of tomato in your stew or anything acidic?
Well, there's a good amount of tomato. There's some wine and there's some broth and there is some tomato paste. So.
Okay. All right. This is the reason I asked. You don't want the beans falling apart.
No.
And beans stay pretty firm when they go into anything containing acid.
Ah.
So that means you might add them like a half hour before the stew is done. They'll absorb some of that flavor. But if there's enough tomato or other acid, maybe some of the stuff from the cooked down wine, they're not going to go to mush on you.
Right.
If you think that there's not quite enough of that in a stew or in a mixture, then you could add the beans the last 10 minutes of cooking.
Really?
Yeah.
So 30 minutes to 10 minutes, depending on the amount of essence.
Yeah, essentially. And then if you really want the beans to pick up a lot of flavor and you have the luxury of making a dish ahead, stir the beans into the dish and then, you know, stick it in the fridge and overnight and then reheat it.
No, that's what the recipe calls for.
Oh, well, this is great. Then put the beans in before.
But you know what happened? I had some old cans. I wanted to use up some cans that have been around for a couple of years, so I wanted to exchange those canned beans for the... But I've got both your ideas, and I appreciate it.
Okay. Just make sure, you know, if those cans are bulging, Harris, you don't
want to use them.
Okay.
The only thing that's bulging is me.
We empathize, Harris.
Yes.
We really empathize.
Well, I love your show, and thank you. Continue on for a long, long time.
Well, thank you for the kind words, and enjoy your beans with the lamb shank, which sounds
all
great.
All right.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. Now we go to Boston to talk to the woman who was named the Best Restaurateur of the Year by the Massachusetts Restaurant Association. The only thing is, technically, she doesn't run a restaurant. Helen Daugherty is head of the Department of Nutrition and Food Services at Boston's Massachusetts General Hospital. We've got her on the phone. Helen, welcome.
Welcome to you.
Helen, I have to confess, this is really hard to believe. I mean, the best restaurateur runs a hospital food service. Come on. We all know what hospital food is about. You paid off the judges, right?
No, no, no. You don't know what hospital food is all about. It's absolutely delicious, good food. And this has been a great experience for us, and we work very hard, and we're getting a lot of people interested and just really having a good time with it. And we are a restaurant. We offer wild choices up here. We have over 900 beds, and our patient menu alone has like 26 choices for breakfast, 38 for lunch and dinner.
Holy cow.
Yeah, so you can have almost anything you want. And the way we cook it, it's good and healthy and tastes delicious.
Okay, so if I'm a patient, what kind of thing would I experience? I mean, give me a specific example.
As you were a patient?
Yeah, let's say I'm a patient. I've come in. I'm going to get my appendix out. So what might I have for breakfast when I can eat again?
When you can eat again, you can have your choice of just about anything. We have scrambled eggs. We have cheese eggs. We have French toast. We have pancakes. We're adding a frittata on our menu with low cholesterol free eggs and pasta and spices. It's delicious for breakfast.
Oh, this sounds pretty
and
good.
We have our own. We have a full bakery here too, so all of our baked goods are all freshly made each morning.
Can I get a sticky bun?
You can.
Well, now I would imagine doing this kind of thing in a hospital is a really big deal. I mean, it's a huge shift in emphasis. How did you deal with your food sources and also with your staff, with the cooks?
I think everybody really, for the cooks, really want to do good things. And I think it was a process of simply re-educating and having them participate in it. One of the real interesting parts about Mass Generals, we're a very diverse group of people. And so what we've done is have our cooks even participate in bringing favorite recipes from home and then making them into these large quantities. And so we had early buy-in, and then we do have standardized recipes now, so you have some good consistency that comes up. But it's hard to fight success, and when people and patients tell you how good the food tastes, because we also have our cooks can go upstairs once a month. We have a trio of people that go to each of the patient floors and talk to the patients, and when you get good feedback, and really, I mean, the part of the reputation of hospital food is certainly for many years we could probably have done better. But a lot of it is the condition of the patient when they're in the hospital and the amount of drugs that are going on and how sick they are and what taste changes happen in their mouth. And so we have to cope with all of those kinds of things. But we do all of our food prepared here from very fresh, first quality ingredients, and we're sort of fanatic about how it gets upstairs.
How did this get started?
Well, let's see. It really started because I became very convinced right before I came to Mass General that hospital food really did not need to be anything other than spectacularly good. And so it sort of was a case of putting my money where my mouth was and came into this facility and decided to make a plan that we would move forward and do this. We would, in fact, serve really good food. And then we also have very large a la carte retail businesses.
Oh, really?
So we serve 13,000 non-patient meals a day as well here.
So I don't have to be sick to come in and eat your food?
No, not at all. Not at all. People from that have business here that are visiting the physicians, people from the neighborhood come in. We even just recently started a senior dinner program with a discount for people over 60 that can come in and eat supper with us. And they have a little ID badge that they get, and we do events for them. So we do all kinds of things.
Well, Helen, the best restaurateur of the year in Boston is running a hospital food program. This is great. Hey, thank you.
Okay.
Helen Daugherty was named the best restaurateur of the year by the Massachusetts Restaurant Association. She is director of the Department of Nutrition and Food Services at Boston's Massachusetts General Hospital. Well, that's all we've got time for today. Thanks, everybody, for joining us. Thanks for calling. Have a great week, and remember, call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. Our answering machine does get lonely. And in the meantime, let me leave you with this thought for the week, a quote from Rita Mae Brown. Lead me not into temptation. I can find the way all by myself. Splendid Table is brought to you by Club Wed Gift Registry at Target, the only place you can register for kitchen essentials. 1810 stainless steel cookware from Calphalon. It's professional quality heavy cookware with tempered glass lids and ergonomic handles. To get information on any of the guests you heard here today, simply mail a self-addressed stamped envelope to the Splendid Table, care of Minnesota Public Radio, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. That's the Splendid Table, care of MPR, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101, or take a look at our website. That address is splendidtable.org. And while you're visiting, be sure to swing by the Splendid Table store. It's an ever-changing collection of things I love to have in my kitchen. And in true public radio style, all the proceeds go to support this program. The Splendid Table is produced by Sally Swift. The associate producers are Jennifer Lubke and Jennifer Russell. Our theme music is by Billy Barber. The Splendid Table is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Bagley Productions. Be sure to join us next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
Public Radio International.